According to the writer Dennis Holy, expecting life to treat you fairly because you're a good person is a little like expecting the bull not to attack you because you're a vegetarian. Bulls can be counted on to do what bulls do, and life can be counted on to do what life does, namely throw us curveballs. Despite all our best efforts to control it, no matter what we might believe about how prepared we are, no matter what we might believe about justice and fairness and who deserves what, no matter what we might believe or not about the existence of a supreme pitcher of life's curveballs, God, as it were, we all get them out of the blue, out of our control. Now, justice and fairness, as we recited this morning, are core to UU principles. You can ask anybody here. And we're all about social justice, too, God knows. Although I sometimes marvel that we say that with a straight face, as if we know what that means, as if it's universally understood. Don't you suppose that the perpetrators of the 9/11 attacks believed in their heart of hearts that they were acting out of a deep sense of justice? The crazy irony to me is that many of us were taught from a very early age that life isn't fair. At the same moment, we were also taught to wait your turn, don't cut in line, give somebody else a chance to play with the ball. I wonder if we spend the rest of our lives trying to reconcile this dance of opposites, knowing it isn't fair, and yet always shooting for and aiming for some sense of justice and fairness, no matter how impossible to define or to realize. Not long ago, I heard a podcast, an episode of This American Life, all about a professional theater director who staged a production of Hamlet in a maximum security men's prison, using the prisoners as actors. As I listened to the stories unfold, my heart just opened up to the astonishing beauty and the healing, redemptive power of art on these wounded souls. Of course, I didn't know anything about the crimes for which they'd been convicted until much later in the hour, but by then it was too late. I'd already fallen in love. Once I did hear about some of those horrors, however, ideas about justice and fairness became far more murky. Here's the very intersection of where inherent worth and dignity meets justice and fairness. Now, it's a common chant to hear at any number of rallies or demonstrations for one just cause or another, no justice, no peace. Of course, I understand. More often than not, I applaud the message and the messenger. But what happens when that injustice hits closer to home, like, say, a diagnosis of cancer? How do we possibly find any peace when confronted with an injustice like that? In my work as an oncology chaplain, I meet folks all over the belief spectrum. And from what I've observed, everyone from the devoutly religious Christian to the cool, cerebral atheist, at some point along the way, bumps into this wall that says, but this isn't fair. I'm a good person. I did everything right. I exercised. I'm a vegan. I got mammograms every 6 months. What do you mean I have stage 4 breast cancer? But I'm only 42 years old. At the same moment, these folks might also espouse that other truism that would say, well, nobody said life's fair, right? The cognitive dissonance between these two perspectives can really pack a wallop to one's spirit, truly intensifying one's suffering. There are also those on the other side who will proclaim from the outset, and often quite proudly, I have never asked why me. Why would I? I look around the world. I see suffering everywhere. I see little kids who get cancer. So I say, why not me? The way I see it, that statement is its own kind of coping strategy, an attempt to construe some sense of peace and some sense of justice and therefore a pathway to peace, because after all, it's impersonal. It's random. Shit happens. Somebody had to get the cancer. Maybe it was my turn. But what I find, though, is even those folks, at some point along the path, will bump into that wall that says, but this isn't right. This is me now. Heidi, 32 years old, newly diagnosed with ovarian cancer. She called the center, desperate for someone to talk to help her make sense of all this. She used that expression several times. She had been raised in a Protestant faith tradition, but more recently had found some inspiration in some Buddhist readings she had done. "Michael, I don't understand how this could be happening to me. I'm a good person. I've never knowingly hurt anybody. I've been taught since I was a little girl to help others. I'm always the first one to volunteer. I've been praying to God so hard, but he won't answer. And I'm so angry. Why is this happening?" She raises so many themes here. Not only this desire to make sense of it, but who or what is God and how does prayer work? But front and center is this theme of justice and fairness. Over my years of reading and study, I've come upon this theory, this hypothesis, that for any genuine transformation to take place, it must be preceded by a betrayal and a death. Betrayal, death, transformation. We might look to the Jesus story as an example that Jesus had to be betrayed, had to die, for the whole centerpiece of Christian theology to take place, resurrection, transformation. This pattern exists in many of the world's great myths, betrayal, death, transformation. It doesn't necessarily mean a physical death, but maybe the death of a belief, an economic or political system, maybe the death of a relationship, maybe the death of a career trajectory. Might be interesting to look back at your own life at moments of profound growth and see if such a moment was in fact preceded by something that could be seen as a betrayal and a death. With Heidi, as it is with so many cancer patients, her old understanding of what's true, who or what is God, how does prayer work, simply wasn't big enough to contain this new reality. It had to be betrayed and it had to die for there to be any possibility of a new truth to be revealed to her, one that would perhaps be big enough to contain this new reality. When we really teased apart her statements and what they revealed about her beliefs, she had to acknowledge that she really believed, if I'm a good person and I do the right thing, I won't get sick and I'll never die. It's not so different, really, from a belief in Santa Claus. If I'm a good little girl, eat my vegetables and don't sass back, I'll get a shiny red bicycle for Christmas. In a way, she had to grieve the death of Santa at 32 years old. It's something for all of us to consider, I think. Can I be open enough and porous enough to allow in a new truth when the old one just isn't big enough to contain this new reality? Angela came to the same spiritual crossroads, but from a very different path. She came from a path of sort of New Age thinking and a belief in affirmations and karma, which is another way of saying it's a just universe out there, right? What goes around comes around. Michael, when I was first diagnosed, I started meditating religiously 5, 6, 7 times a day, passionate about it. And then my scans came back and revealed disease progression, and I felt so betrayed. And I realized I wasn't meditating for the right reason at all, not for the peace it could give me in that moment. I was meditating because I thought it might cure me. Both Heidi and Angela were attached to a very specific outcome, namely cure, as the one way to affirm and verify that there was indeed justice in the world. It was the only thing that would do. It would have to be the most human of all urges. Who doesn't want to be cured of cancer? But what if it's simply not in the cards? What if the most either could hope for would simply be more time living with chronic illness? Or what if, God forbid, this disease does mean the imminent end of my physical body? Am I not entitled to an experience of peace? Am I not entitled to an experience of healing that may not include cure? How does one possibly come to peace when confronted with injustice like that? Abby is 48 years old. She's an artist and a teacher. She also lost the love of her life, her husband Paul of 20-some years, to pancreatic cancer. Paul and Abby never had children. They filled their lives with their love of each other, their dogs, their work, and their beloved Christian Science faith community. It was a centerpiece of their world. When Paul was first diagnosed and given a poor prognosis, even with medical intervention, despite the tenets of their faith and the admonitions of their faith community, they decided to go for it. Life was too precious not to give him this shot. He did last for 2 grueling years with treatment, but the disease did take his life. And their choice to use medical intervention ended up costing them their faith community, which was a devastating blow for both of them. He's been gone for over 2 years, and Abby still struggles so desperately with ideas about justice and fairness. Michael, I don't understand it. He was such a good person. Why him? Why me? Why us? Even though in the same breath she would say, and I don't even believe in that stuff anymore, that God rewards good and punishes evil. Her grief is so deep, it's so profound, it's so complete that she finds herself without any hope whatsoever. No faith to lean on. And what's more, no desire for more life. And yet she confides, I would never consider taking my own life. Why not? I asked. I love my parents too much. I couldn't do that to them. I love my dogs, and they need me. And if there is life on the other side, I want to spend it with Paul. What if doing that meant I couldn't be with him? So we concluded that she still did have faith in love. It was enough, perhaps, to keep her here by a thread. So we started there, just perhaps laying the foundation for transformation. Betrayal, death, transformation. Standing on the other side of all these stories, struggling to claim justice, is Lyle. Lyle's in his mid-70s. He's a crusty fellow with this good old boy southern drawl and demeanor about him. He's lived the life of a loner, kind of an outcast, had spent some pretty turbulent years there. He does love to ride his motorcycle, though. That's the place he finds his peace. He also finds himself with a diagnosis of stage 4 lung cancer, living in an assisted living facility where he says the subject of Judgment Day, who gets into heaven and who doesn't, is a constant topic of conversation in the elevator and in the community room, which he calls God's little waiting room. Now, Lyle would never identify as religious by any stretch, but his Southern Baptist roots do run pretty deep. And the core of his spiritual distress is, Michael, what if I don't get into heaven? In other words, what if there is justice and I'm standing on the wrong side of it? I asked Lyle, if he were God, would he condemn himself to hell? And he thought for a moment, said, you know, Michael, no, I would not. I would say, Lyle, you should have gone to church more. You should have kept my day holy, kept my Sabbath. But no, you can go to heaven. Go on now. I was glad to hear it. I asked him if he thought perhaps riding his Harley at PCH on a gorgeous Sunday morning with the sun and wind in his face, feeling grateful to be alive, might be its own kind of worship. Might be its own kind of prayer, its own way of keeping the Sabbath holy. He liked that idea, I must say. Speaking of modes of transportation serving as a pathway to spiritual awakening, I don't know what it is about me and my 12-year-old car that can absolutely bring me to my knees, but there you have it. It's not the first time a little episode with my Prius has found its way into a sermon. Not long ago, I was at fault in a little fender bender. I clipped the rear bumper of this very expensive, gigantic SUV. I have also shared in the past that such careless human mistakes on my part that cost real money to remedy caused me unrelenting self-reproach. The owner of the SUV was gracious enough to allow me to give her the $700 to fix the few scratches on her bumper without putting it through my insurance. Damage on my car was another story. The front bumper and the hood were pretty badly squashed, but it was all cosmetic damage. I didn't even consider the possibility of getting the car fixed. It's an old car. I certainly don't need to spend my money on that. And more to the point, I don't deserve it. But in the days and weeks to follow, I have to say, every time I went to get in or out of my car and was confronted with that damage again, I suffered all over again. Punishing myself. How could you have been so stupid? How could you have been so careless? I think my husband Scott got a little weary of listening to me, and he finally said, why don't you just get a couple bids to find out what you're talking about to get the damn car fixed? So I went to a few body shops, feeling so much shame and embarrassment to admit this is my fault and that's why I'm not putting it through insurance, as if they care. And the best bid I could find was $1,500. Well, forget it. I'm not spending that out of the question. Around the same time, a dear friend called, and I was deeply honored when he asked me to officiate at his mother's funeral. There'd be a small graveside service. Whenever I am asked to officiate at a funeral or a memorial service, I always feel as if I'm being bestowed with a sacred trust. And of course I am. And given the work that I do, as you might imagine, I always see the big picture and hold the higher perspective. The thought actually crossed my mind, what's everybody going to think at the cemetery when they see the minister get out of this beat-up old car? The more I thought about it, though, a new idea came to me, which for me felt huge. What if I chose to get my car fixed, and instead of seeing it as a punishment or a penalty, I chose to see it as an opportunity, maybe even as a spiritual exercise? What if I saw it as an opportunity to invest in my own peace of mind? What if I were to invest in forgiveness? What if I were to invest in grace to be a human being who could make a mistake? For me, this was huge, and so that's what I did. I picked up the car the day before the funeral, so glad to have it back. I got up early that morning to drive to the cemetery. It felt so nice to have my car all clean, refreshed, restored. I get to the cemetery a little early to tend to a few details before the guests arrive. I actually caught myself glancing across the lawn to see my car parked over there, looking its best, feeling kind of good about that. In a cemetery, the place where one contemplates the eternal and what's truly essential in life. The funeral was on a Wednesday morning, and I needed to get back to work afterward. So I stopped at a Pollo Loco to grab a quick lunch before heading back to UCLA. And I was careful to park on the far side of the lot, just to be careful. I know you know what that's like. And when I came out of the restaurant after lunch, I couldn't believe my eyes. My car sat over there by itself, rear bumper completely smashed. Are you kidding me? I can't have my car nice for a day. I don't even have the Visa bill yet for the $1,500. And look at this. So much for my investment in my own peace of mind. So much for my little spiritual exercise. I went out of my mind. It was as if a dam had burst. Not knowing what else to do, I picked up the phone to call Scott, and I got his voicemail, and I just ranted and wailed and screamed and cried into that phone. It must have been some kind of sight to see me in my good suit and dress shoes running around that Pollo Loco parking lot, screaming and crying into my phone, I can't believe this, I can't accept this. Look at what I do for a living, for so little money. Is it too much to ask to have a 12-year-old car be nice for longer than a day when I'm willing to spend $1,500 to keep it nice? Is it too much? And at the same moment, I'm acutely aware this is an obscenely over-the-top, inappropriate response to something so insignificant and inconsequential, particularly given the work that I do. Every day, I walk beside people facing real tragedy, and look at how I'm carrying on. But the thing is, a core wound had been ripped open, and the bleeding was unstoppable. And that wound is that place that lives within me, that I think lives within many of us, I think, that is so firmly attached to the idea that life should be fair and the world should be just and people should do the right thing, goddammit. And at this stage of my life, I find when those core wounds get ripped open, the best strategy I have is to simply stand in awe and bear witness to the power of the wound. Rather than try to talk myself out of it, rationalize why it is I should feel or respond differently than I do. You don't rationalize with a screaming baby. You pick up the baby and you hold it and you say, there, there, until the wailing subsides. Several months earlier, one of the chemo nurses referred me to Valerie, 36 years old, on her first day of chemotherapy. Valerie's a working mom, 6-year-old daughter, newly diagnosed with breast cancer. When I first met Valerie, she said, yeah, Michael, at first I really did struggle with why me, but I've put all that behind me now, and I just want to focus on getting through treatment. The longer we talked, it became painfully clear that as much as she would like to have believed that were true, it simply was not. She very much was struggling with why me. In the core of her spiritual distress was not so much her diagnosis as it was hearing the news that she would now never be able to have any more children. She and her husband had been desperately trying to get pregnant at the time of her diagnosis. She was also very weary of trying to keep spiritual scorecards. I know, Michael, I should feel grateful. Look, I have one healthy child, and I have a wonderful husband and family, and I have good medical insurance to pay for all of this. She grew even less patient with those in her world who wanted to keep that spiritual scorecard for her, on her behalf. Valerie, look at it this way. Do you know how many people can't have even one child? You should be grateful and count your blessings. No one was simply allowing her to experience her grief, her loss, her devastation, her disappointment. Be a witness to it. I visited her regularly throughout her chemo infusions, and that grip of injustice never did loosen from around her throat. With her chemo now complete, next step in treatment was surgery. I went to see her in the hospital the day after her radical double mastectomy. First thing out of her mouth, Michael, look at all those sweet get well cards everybody sent me over there on the shelf. Look at all those balloons that say get well on them. I just can't let it go. Those should have said congratulations. Welcome to the new baby. My little Pollo Loco catastrophe had been just a couple days earlier, and I took a big risk in choosing to tell her about it. Not remotely to commiserate or to compare suffering, but to try to illustrate the power of a core wound when it's been ripped open. One that I believe Valerie and I share. This isn't right. It isn't fair. I believe we share it as Americans, particularly for those of us who identify as white Americans, that perhaps we are hardwired to have this expectation that life be fair and just. I don't think all cultures have such an expectation. And when we are confronted then with that wound being ripped open and faced with the devastation and the disappointment and the dashed hopes, fueled by that expectation nursed over the course of a lifetime, maybe we need to learn to go a little easy on ourselves. So I would ask myself, can I come to a new relationship with that wound, a new kind of peace with it? Can I learn to live in the tension between this dance of opposites between two competing realities or perspectives? On one side that would say, life isn't fair, it's all random, shit happens, it's impersonal. But on the other side, sometimes it seems like justice is served. Sometimes it seems like I get what I deserve. Sometimes it even seems like things happen for a reason. More to the point, can I offer grace to that part of myself that still clings so desperately to my idea of what's just and fair, just like the crazy man I was in that Pollo Loco parking lot? Can that grace be big enough to know that that part of me might never let go? Maybe nurturing that grace for myself might offer a kind of pathway to peace with injustice. We'll just have to see. I'm working on it. So be it. Thank you.